This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Taking aim at the opioid crisis. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The startling number of deaths from opioid overdoses have brought together a team of experts for a summit in Philadelphia. Find out what they're working on.
The agony of having a car repossessed, then still having to pay the debt for years.
Also on the consumer front, the man who battled for 8 months to get a refund from an airline.
And the effort to get us to use the word whom in its proper form.
Well, whom is a part of speech. It's the objective form of who, and some people are really annoyed at how it's disappearing. And you know, the one thing that I have seen often, for those of you who are on Twitter, but I think it's also on LinkedIn, you know, it tells you who to follow. And I've seen a bunch of people say, like, come on, Twitter, really? It's whom to follow. Everyone knows that.
Wall Street Journal reporter Spencer Jacob on who versus whom and who is behind the push for whom. Well, on a serious note, important work is underway on solutions for America's problem with drugs. Philadelphia this past week hosted the first ever summit called Solving the Opioid Crisis. One of the participants was Dr. Kerry Donaldson, founder and CEO of Prescient Medicine. He's with us from Philadelphia. Doctor, give us the current landscape.
Really, the first thing that you have to understand when you talk about this opioid crisis or epidemic is the scope and the magnitude of what we're dealing with right now. And in 2015, around 55,000 patients died with opioid-related overdoses or drug overdoses in the U.S. And again, that number's thrown out there. The first thing to understand is, you know, how does that relate to day-to-day life? And I like to give it in terms of other mass casualty events that we know as part of our national awareness, one of which is 9/11. Around 3,000 Americans died on 9/11. The size of what we're dealing with right now, that's like one to two 9/11s happening every month, all year long.
Yeah,
that's how impactful this is. Another way to think about this is the Vietnam War. Over 20 years, we lost around 55,000 lives. Again, the opioid crisis or epidemic here in the U.S. currently, is that happening every single year instead of 20? That's the magnitude of what we're dealing with. And I think it's very sobering to start a discussion on opioids with those types of statistics before we get to the solutions or what you can do to prevent it. You have to understand that this is really almost an unparalleled impact on our day-to-day lives.
And why is this happening? Because there's a lot of folks here, right, who wouldn't fit what you might consider in your mind, the profile of a typical drug addict.
Yeah, it crosses all. One of the conceptually hard things to get around, too, is this crosses all socioeconomic statuses. You see this across middle America, in fact, middle America, Appalachia, inner cities, places where you don't have a lot of resource in terms of acute care or emergency physicians is where you see this impacted hardest. But again, to your point, you see it everywhere. And what are the feeders, really? I'm internalizing your question saying what is the feeder of this solution? About 4 to 5 of patients that eventually become dependent upon heroin or addicted to heroin, start with prescription drugs or prescription opioids. So again, 80% of patients that become or persons that become addicted to heroin really start with opioids. So when you look at this solution, you have to understand that we have to talk about the prescription drugs as part of not only the problem, but really an area that we can affect. And what makes us a little bit different, in fact, we are the only peer-reviewed publication out there that has the ability to talk about, prior to giving an opioid, what's the likelihood of that patient developing dependency.
Mm.
And again, this is a comprehensive solution. That's one of 5 solutions that we have that we've come together to discuss at this summit. We've been doing this for quite some time. But really, to stem the flow, you have to stop that feeder, which is the prescription opioid abuse.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Kerry Donaldson, founder and CEO of Prescient Medicine. We're talking about the first ever Solving the Opioid Crisis Summit, which is taking place in Philadelphia. All right, so I have kind of a strange question with regards to addiction then.
Sure.
Is a person who gets addicted to opioids, does that person already have, say, an addictive personality? In other words, if it wasn't opioids, were they open to getting addicted to something else like booze or gambling?
Good question, Gordon. Yeah, so what I can tell you is what the science says, right? And the science says, and what we've answered so far, is there's definitely a predisposition for opioid dependency, right? So do those pathways, does that same type of test generalize to other addiction-type personalities? We haven't answered that definitively. Okay. We are working on that question with alcohol.
Mm. So it's possible then that the opioids themselves could be creating some sort of addiction that maybe was not present in the person.
It is. It is. And yeah. It's important to understand that this is a continuum of disease, that just like alcoholism is a continuum of disease, that prevention is really the first thing that you want to talk about here, and not exposing a patient that has a high likelihood of addiction. But once somebody has a dependency on these drugs, what medication do you give to detoxify that patient, or how do you monitor that patient over time, and how do you get them to recovery? Those are all portions of the solution, and the reason that we have a summit is that we have world experts in all of those areas that have come together over the last 6 months putting real-time solutions in play today. So this isn't something that's in the future. This is happening right now, and we're making a difference.
Is there a general feel as to how long you might take an opioid before you get addicted to it?
There are dependency questions, but again, these are individual evaluations. The likelihood of developing addiction, 10 states across the U.S. have limited primary prescriptions of painkillers to 7 days or less.
Okay.
So that's what they're trying to do with those types of solutions. But the real answer is if you have a likelihood of developing dependency, maybe one is too much and a million are never enough, that kind of old analogy.
Thanks, Doctor. Dr. Kerry Donaldson, founder and CEO of Prescient Medicine. It's 13 minutes now after the hour. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. You know, for millions of Americans who have shaky credit and had to turn to subprime auto loans with high interest rates and hefty fees to buy a car, there is no getting out if you default on the loan. Many of these auto loans, it turns out, have a habit of haunting people long after their cars have been repossessed. It's a fascinating story by Michael Corkery, finance reporter at the New York Times. Michael, what happens here?
What happens is for, millions of Americans that need a car to get to work or basically to just get around in life, who don't have the money or who have very poor credit, they often will have to go to a lender that charges them very high interest rates to buy a car that's, many years used. And when that car breaks down, as it inevitably does, or if people run into financial problems and they can't pay their bills, the car will be repossessed. But these particular lenders, what they do after repossessing the car is they also will then take the borrower to court and sue them for the amount of money that remains on the loan. Mm. And often they win every time. And so what happens if they do win, they get a judgment against the borrower, and then they can garnish their wages and take a chunk of their paycheck for years to pay off the loan.
Wow. All right, so a slightly off the beaten path question here, but and I assume a lot of these folks don't show up to court when they're told they're going to be sued or have their wages garnished. If they were to somehow come up with the money to afford an attorney, could they avoid these issues?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, that's the crux. I mean, these companies that basically have these mills. I mean, there's this one, Credit Acceptance, is a big subprime auto lender. I mean, New York State alone sued 17,000 people since 2010. They count on people not showing up in court. Nice. And I mean, it's financial deals can be complicated. I mean, they're complicated to anybody. Legal situations are even more complicated. A lot of people will get these, they'll be served with a lawsuit. They won't know what it is. They won't show up in court. And then by default, the lender wins. So yeah, sure. If you could afford some legal assistance, you know, from, you know, pro bono, or even afford a lawyer, chances are you probably can. If you're not able to pay your bill, you probably could beat this in some way, or cut out a deal,
right,
where some of the debt might be forgiven, but they wouldn't do things so extreme like literally taking a chunk of your paycheck in perpetuity until the loan's paid off.
I mean, you open your story with this woman who's got this 1997 Mitsubishi, was repossessed in 2004. 13 years later, she's still paying off the loan. What were the numbers on that?
Yeah, I think her specific situation, I think it was like a $10,000 loan. She paid maybe $4,000 on it. They sued and garnished her wages for another $4,000, and then they're still going after like $2,000 more she still owes. I mean, it's a slow chipping away, and you know, for people on the financial margins, you know, a few hundred dollars every month is a big deal. I mean, her specific situation, she ended up having a public assistance. She had a job and everything, but she still needed help to raise her two boys because this money was coming out every month.
We're speaking with Michael Corkery, finance reporter at the New York Times. He's written a piece entitled "The Car Was Repossessed, But the Debt Remains." Those credit companies, I mean, once they go to court and are garnishing wages, that's a revenue guarantee, pretty much, unlike when the customer was probably defaulting on the loan and not making payments.
Right. It's like an annuity.
Yeah.
And they don't have to actually, I mean, think of the expense of collecting debt, you know, phone calls, letters. You need none of that. Your expenses are nothing. And you know, there's been a lot of, been an increase in defaults, and, certainly some investors have invested in these loans are going to take a loss. But it's very interesting that a lot of these lenders themselves, like this Credit Acceptance, I mean, it's been able to grow profit 25% over the past, in the first quarter from the year earlier. I mean, they're doing just fine because they have these tactics that allow them to collect so efficiently.
Thanks, Michael. Michael Corkery, finance reporter at the New York Times. It's 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to grow or start your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Well, here's a sentence that will either surprise you or confirm all the generalizations you have about millennials, who are today's young adults. Claiming that prospective hires are too slow to pick up the phone or respond to emails, employers are trying out apps that allow them to conduct early stage interviews with texts. Wall Street Journal reporter Kelsey G says recruiters are finding that fewer potential hires are answering their phones, even when they're looking for a job. Kelsey, seriously?
So recruiters and employers of all types are having more trouble getting young workers to answer the phone. And even when they do answer the phone, it seems like there's often a lag between when folks can connect. And, I think there's a lot of desperation in some corners of the world for entry-level talent. And so text messaging seems to be an alternative option.
Man, can you – all right. Do you happen to be a millennial?
I do, yeah.
Okay, so can you explain to me this mindset? And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, this is maybe a new college grad or somebody out of school for a handful of months looking for that full-time job, and they're not picking up the phone when it rings? What's going on here?
So there just seems to be a lot of aversion to talking on the phone for this generation that can so easily text or send, just like other short snippets of information via like Snapchat, or there's just so many other ways to communicate these days. So that if people are out with their friends or they're in the middle of something, rather than answering to say that they're in the middle of something, I know a lot of people who just will let the phone call go to voicemail and will just text afterwards saying that they're busy.
Wow. Maybe because I'm older. I can't even process that you wouldn't pick up the phone when you're looking for a job and you know you have lines in the water, right? Or irons in the fire. So now, right, employers are forced to adapt to this. What are they doing?
Yeah, so there are a handful of new – so this started in part because I heard of this company called Canvas, which is a job interviewing platform that's all via text. It's where recruiters or employers can have text message conversations where they do basically what they would do in a phone screening call, where they just ask basic, you know, background information about people's last jobs, you know, why they left, what motivated them, the kinds of opportunities they're looking for. And so many millennials these days, you know, have no problem answering in-depth questions about their experiences and their goals via text message. So this is just a platform for those initial conversations to take place. And I realize it's not the only one like this. This is increasingly how more and more employers are hosting those initial conversations in either an app like Canvas or some of its competitors, like Monster has one as well.
Wow. We're speaking with Kelsey G, Wall Street Journal management reporter. She's written a piece entitled "When Texting Might Get You the Job." All right. So what you said there kind of opens the door to the next line of questions. That's what about etiquette for this job interview texting?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think for generations that didn't grow up texting, it seems like a really, you know, like a short, informal way of communicating. But for folks for whom, you know, texting is their main way of communicating, I mean, it's totally possible to, you know, throughout the course of my own interviews with one of the sources in this story, I texted a lot of my reporting conversation. And, you know, there were like paragraph breaks, there was perfect punctuation.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's some open questions about, you know, like, well, what do you do about emoji?
Yeah.
Or, you know, can you be kind of playful and silly?
That's a real interview, by the way. That's a real story that she did. Wall Street Journal reporter Kelsey G. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka coming up this half hour. No Lufthansa, I won't wait 8 months for a response. Also, the bell tolls for whom? And the British man who wore a dress to work to protest his company's dress code. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, how much do you know about post-traumatic stress disorder? It's a massive issue for our returning soldiers. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
June is PTSD Awareness Month, a time when the Real Warriors campaign is asking us to honor the sacrifices of our military. Joining us to talk about the campaign is retired Army Major Ed Pulido, a Purple Heart recipient who was severely injured in Iraq. Major, can you give us some details about your experience with PTSD?
Well, I will tell you that on August 17th of 2004, I hit an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb, that, of course, changed my life and my family's life forever. But as I always say, it was the best thing that ever happened to me on that day. I was honored. I certainly came home and was given the services and the support that I needed to be strong. And as I always say with the Real Warriors campaign, it's real warriors, real battles, real strength. That's what they did for me, and certainly they were able to render aid and provide support, resources, and I live a great life now because of the fact that, you know what, I have a campaign that really hones in not only on my story, but can be a story for everyone that needs support, opportunity, and more importantly, a way for recovery.
Major, what are some of the struggles that you were facing when you returned home?
Well, so the struggles, of course, was just dealing with the fact that at the beginning, losing my left leg was an issue, physical issues. And then, of course, for many months, I really didn't deal with the mental health side of it. And the great thing about it is that I was able to get the support I needed, whether it was counseling, to having someone to be able to talk to, the peer-to-peer support. And then, you know, you go through a different phase where, you know, it's time for you to leave the military and do something different. And to me, I looked at it as a positive as well to say, you know what, my career is over in the military, but it's just beginning in the civilian sector, but what can I do to give back? And that's what the Real Warriors campaign is all about, is giving back, making sure that the services are available, and that, you know what, folks like you understand that we need your support to make sure that the community understands that this is a big issue and one that we need to make sure that we have services in place for.
How can family members and friends help if they see someone struggling with PTSD?
Well, what they can do is they can connect to the Real Warriors Campaign website. They can also call our outreach center. That number is 866-966-1020. Go to realwarriors.net on the web, and that website will just give you so much information and give you some tips on things that you may be able to do for your loved one. And of course, our video profiles and PSAs, articles, and then of course, you know, social media is so big right now that that's a way to get connected to this campaign. And more importantly, send this to a warrior and say, hey, if you need help, we have a campaign and we have a website and we have information and we have people ready and available to help you.
We are speaking with Army Major Ed Pulido. Major, are we starting to learn how to better deal with PTSD and other issues that either retired military personnel have or other veterans?
You know, that's a great question. I'm asked that a lot, and I would say yes. The reason is that we have a lot of these campaigns. We have a lot of services. The Department of Defense has recognized this. We're training our leaders, our frontline leaders in the military about these issues and how they can basically take charge and educate, and more importantly, not just do a PowerPoint presentation and say, okay, here's the information, but how do we live it, and how do we breathe it, and more importantly, how do we use it? And that, to me, is game-changing, and that's what's different from the past, and that's where we're going in the present and certainly in the future.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Army Major Ed Pulido. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Ever go to war with an airline when you think you've been wronged? It's like you're an army of one, right, against hundreds of people seemingly conspiring to make your life miserable. Consumer advocate Christopher Elliott has the story of a man who waited 8 months to get a refund from Lufthansa for $900. Chris, what's up with this?
Yeah, this was a guy who booked. The flight was canceled. He then canceled his ticket and did not get a refund. So the airline came back to him, and it refused a refund, even though he had canceled within 24 hours, and they said, nope, according to our clock, you did not cancel within 24 hours, therefore, no refund. And this all goes back to that 24-hour rule that the DOT, the Department of Transportation, put into effect several years ago. And they said, hey, if you're going to cancel your airline ticket within 24 hours, you do deserve a full and entire refund. And so he thought he was going to get that refund. Lufthansa begged to differ.
Wow. All right, so then this chain of events, right? You get involved. You call, the agent traces the canceled flight and refund, and then you're told on behalf of this guy the refund would take 7 to 10 days. 2 weeks later, yeah. Nothing.
Yeah. Well, he waited 8 months, actually, for this refund, which is a little bit ridiculous. So once Lufthansa went out and did its forensics on this, they realized that he had canceled within 24 hours. But even then, it still took a good long while before he got his refund back. Now, this is a column that I write every week called The Travel Troubleshooter, and it runs in a lot of syndicated outlets. And you know, every week I take a seemingly intractable travel problem and try to fix it for a reader. And this was one of those issues where if the airline had just gone back and looked at its own records, it would have realized, yes, he had canceled within 24 hours. Yes, he's owed a refund. And yes, we should pay it back within 7 to 10 days. Actually, 7 business days is what the DOT requires. So they really fell down on this particular case. And I was happy to be able to help this guy pick up the pieces and get his refund.
Goodness. So, I mean, was Lufthansa just hoping the guy would go away and they'd get to just pocket his $912, or is this just incompetence? Like, what happened here?
I hope that it was just incompetence, but I suspect that large companies do have kind of an unofficial policy that if you say no enough times, people will just go away.
Yeah.
You see that happening time and again, not just with airlines, but with a lot of different companies where you have the boilerplate rejection followed by another boilerplate rejection, and they're hoping that people will just walk away and think, well, I have no choice.
We're speaking with Christopher Elliott, consumer expert, travel expert. His book is called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. And this piece he's written is called No Lufthansa, I Won't Wait 8 Months for a Response. So ultimately here, you can help yourself out, as you say, and the key is meticulous paperwork. Like what, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you're going to cancel your flight, you have to get a cancellation number. And I don't think he did. I think he just called and assumed that this was taken care of.
Mm.
Whenever someone cancels any kind of transaction, this is not just for airlines, they will usually, a large company will issue a cancellation number or cancellation code. Get that, because that is your evidence that the transaction's been canceled and that you're entitled to a refund. I think that if he had gotten that, then this would have been a much easier case to advocate.
Thanks, Chris. That's consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. 14 minutes now in front of the hour. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. As the word home is increasingly neglected and scorned in popular culture, diehard grammarians are fighting to save it. Like who? Wall Street Journal columnist Spencer Jacob explores for whom this is relevant. Spencer, explain.
Well, whom is a part of speech. It's the objective form of who. And some people are really annoyed at how it's disappearing. And, you know, the one thing that I have seen often, for those of you who are on Twitter, but I think it's also on LinkedIn, you know, it tells you who to follow on the right side of your screen. And I've seen a bunch of people say, like, come on, Twitter, really? It's whom to follow. Everyone knows that. And I spoke with Twitter about it, and, you know, they've been contacted about it jillions of times, and they, you know, they do know grammar, but they just decided it sounded more natural.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of the basic conflict is, you know, using who doesn't really, or whom, doesn't clarify anything. It's not like some other things in grammar where you're confusing people with what you mean. It's
right.
Just what's right and what's wrong. But some people feel pretty strongly about it.
All right. So is this is it a lazy thing to, I don't know, not make the effort to figure out when you should use who versus whom?
It's not really that hard. I think people think it's hard, but it's like, you know, you wouldn't say, you know, he and him, right? I mean, you know how to use that, and it's the same exact rules apply to who and whom. It's just people find it a little bit tougher to remember. But also because there are so many things in popular culture that use it incorrectly. I mean, you know, who do you love? Bo Diddley, right? That's not correct. It's whom do you love, you know? Or, you know, there are a bunch of other things. I mean, so it's... There are lots and lots of things that are out there that would sound weird if they were written correctly. And we've become, in definitely the way we speak, we've almost completely dropped whom. And I did an analysis of how often whom is used in books relative to who, which would be kind of pretty constant, right?
I mean,
it's what part of speech. And that's declined a lot, too. So it's kind of going away the way of the dodo. But I found some interesting characters who care a lot about it.
That's funny. So I hear your Bo Diddley / George Thorogood reference, and I raise you Metallica, which did it correctly in For Whom the Bell Tolls. Right, so there you go.
Well, that's exactly. Although, you know, Hemingway would be rolling in his grave, right? I mean, that's they took it from. But absolutely, you don't see, no one writes a letter to who it may concern. So there's still some things where whom shows up, but just very formal context, usually written English. One guy I spoke to wrote a book about it. He's a science fiction writer and a literature professor from the UK, and he wrote Doctor Whom, the grammatically correct Time Lord. And it's really, really funny. He goes and corrects all sorts of bad grammar throughout time and space. And some people are, you know, really, really, really obsessed with it. Although even people who wrote books on language, people who will always get it right 100% of the time, you know, who know every single grammar rule and would be mortified to get them wrong, just they say, like, it's a little stilted to always get that one right. It just makes you sound like a butler or something.
I'd say there's some sort of association too, like these people who congregate and I guess to discuss. Oh, the Home Appreciation Society. Explain that.
Yes, of which I'm. I joined some weeks ago, so you'll find me there. I'm a member of the Home Appreciation Society, which I do appreciate. Home.
Wall Street Journal columnist Spencer Jacob. Coming up next, the British man who wore a dress to work. Glad you could be with us. A man in England began following the female dress code at work after he was sent home for wearing shorts. UPI says a guy named Joey Barge attempted to wear shorts and a black dress shirt to his job at a call center during a heat wave in the UK. Monday, he asked on Twitter, quote, "If women can wear skirts or dresses at work, can I wear smart shorts like so?" and posted a picture. Shortly afterward, he posted an update stating that he'd been sent home from work for violating the company's dress code. He decided to return to the office wearing a black dress with pink and orange stripes, stating he expected to be sent home once again. But Mr. Barge received an unexpected reaction when he returned to work and was pulled into an office to be informed male employees would be permitted to wear shorts due to his statement. Mr. Barge wrote alongside a photo of an office memo announcing the dress code change and used the caption, "Partial win." Mr. Barge said he was given the opportunity to go home and change out of the dress, but he decided to keep the outfit for the rest of the day. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.